It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferris. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up on Central Time, we'll get the latest on what's happening with Russia and the U.S., the latest poll numbers, and more in our weekly check-in on national politics.
First, legislation circulated in Wisconsin would allow people to carry concealed weapons without a permit or training. The bill would also end the state's ban on tasers and would let some people bring guns onto federal gun-free school zones.
The bill is authored by Senator David Craig and Representative Mary Felskowski, both Republicans. It would make Wisconsin a constitutional carry state that lets people carry weapons without having to register with the state or pay government fees. Supporters say the bill puts Wisconsin's concealed carry law in line with the state's policy that lets people openly carry without training or permits. Those against the bill say it's irresponsible and potentially dangerous.
Robert Spitzer joins us now. He's a distinguished service professor and department chair for political science at the State University of New York, Cortland. He's written 5 books on gun control in the United States. Robert, welcome to Central Time.
It's good to be with you.
Nationwide, how unusual is a bill like this one proposed, a bill that would allow people to carry concealed weapons without a permit or training?
Well, quite a movement has spread in recent years to advance this idea. As of today, there are 12 states that have eliminated permitting entirely for civilians to carry handguns around with them concealed, and there is legislation in other state legislatures that are proceeding sort of in the way Wisconsin is right now. However, it's a relatively new phenomenon. If you go back to the start of the 1980s, only one state of the union did not require a permit for a civilian to carry a handgun around in society concealed. And it really has been only in recent years that number has grown significantly.
And supporters of this bill say it would make Wisconsin a constitutional carry state. Can you walk us through what that means?
Well, I think that term, frankly, is something of a misnomer because it presumes that there is a constitutional right for citizens, for civilians, to carry concealed weapons around with them in society, or for that matter, even to carry them openly. And there is no such constitutional right. Now, there are cases before the court right now that are trying to establish this as a right. But as of today, the Second Amendment right for civilians, as the Supreme Court defined it back in 2008, says that people have a right to own a handgun for personal self-protection in the home. It says nothing about carrying weapons around in society with you as a constitutional right. It is something that is now allowable with a permit in most states, of course, but the point is that the states have some discretion about that, and states that have fairly restrictive permitting requirements, such as New York State, have been challenged. Strict laws have been challenged in the courts, and they have withstood scrutiny. Now, constitutional scrutiny. It is certainly also an assumption that the kind of law being considered by Wisconsin is kind of a return to earlier times when people carried guns more freely, but that's actually not correct either. The idea that civilians ought not to be carrying weapons around with them, especially concealed, is something that is really that standard has been a very long one. Let me rephrase. The idea that civilians ought not to be carrying weapons around concealed is a very long one. By the end of the 19th century, every state in the Union, except for 4 states, had laws that severely restricted or barred civilians from carrying concealed weapons at all. That was the norm until we hit the 1980s, when the gun rights movement really took off and they began to push the loosening up of such gun regulations in state legislatures. And that's what brings us to where we are today.
Now, if we put the term constitutional carry aside and what it might entail in terms of the Constitution itself, what does a constitutional carry state legally allow its citizens to do?
Well, in the states, the dozen states that today have eliminated permitting, it means that indeed, as long as citizens can legally own a handgun, they are entitled to carry that handgun around with them concealed as they go about their business. There are limitations on that. For example, businesses can post signs that we don't want people carrying guns into our place of business. Various public institutions, public buildings can impose similar restrictions. And there is a similar debate, I know, going on in Wisconsin about this right now in your legislature about where this should not be allowed. But the fundamental core principle is that the operative principle is that if you sweep away state permits, that means you're also sweeping away any state requirements, like, for example, that a person would have to take a training course or take a written test that demonstrates knowledge of firearms or other similar requirements. So states have the option of doing that, and indeed a dozen states have done it so far.
We're talking with Robert Spitzer right now, Distinguished Service Professor, Department Chair for Political Science at the State University of New York, Cortland, joining us to look at a bill proposed here in Wisconsin that would allow citizens to carry concealed weapons without a permit or training. And Robert, do we have data on where public opinion stands on bills like this?
Generally speaking, the public does not favor, or the public opposes, the idea of civilians carrying guns concealed around in society in their normal business. And I think that's a pretty consistent finding among national public opinion polls. In states where there is a stronger gun tradition, you would find less support. But I think even among gun owners, you will find that most gun owners are very leery of the idea of civilians carrying weaponry around with them. I mean, we have to remember, especially given the notion that the bill being considered in Wisconsin, does away with training requirements and other requirements that many states still have on the books for their citizens to obtain permitting. So it's not something that meets wide public favor, but it has become a real cause celeb for the gun rights community.
Now, another aspect of this bill would end a restriction under current law that would prevent people from bringing guns into police stations, secure mental health facilities, and schools. So how controversial is that particular provision?
Well, it's pretty controversial, as you can imagine. We've had national legislation that, for example, that bars, going back more than 20 years, that bars people from carrying guns onto grounds of public schools generally. Every state of the union has had a similar law in place, although some states have repealed or modified those laws. And I think generally when you check with law enforcement organizations, with district attorney's offices, with prosecuting attorneys and such, and others in the law enforcement community, they generally oppose civilians being able to carry around weapons without a permit, partly because it means that law enforcement has no way of determining who has proper permits and who does not. And also because it encourages civilians to intervene, if they have firearms on their person, in situations where they think they might be doing good and where, in fact, they might, and indeed probably more likely, may be causing more confusion and possible harm. And law enforcement doesn't need that added degree of insecurity when they're trying to do their job.
We got an email here from Mike in Sheboygan County, who's a former law enforcement officer, and he says the police chiefs of Wisconsin oppose concealed carry bills because they could lead, he says, to a 16% increase in police deaths by firearms. What about that figure, Robert? Is that a figure that you've seen?
I've not heard the 16% figure, although I'm sure there are studies that have examined this question just as he reports. And it has a couple of very specific effects and why it could lead to a greater likelihood of death. First because civilians may have guns and may use them either accidentally or intentionally, thinking that they're doing good or perhaps not to do something good. And secondly, it ratchets up the uncertainty of everyday encounters between police officers and civilians on the street. And when you ratchet up insecurity in an actual confrontation between a police officer who carries a service weapon and a civilian who the officer doesn't know if they have a weapon or not, it leads and encourages a confrontation and makes more likely the prospect of a confrontation where either an innocent civilian could be injured or killed or a police officer injured or killed.
And Robert, you're a member of the NRA and also the Brady Center to Prevent Gun Violence. Do you have any informed thoughts about the data out there about what could or should be required of people who do want to carry a concealed weapon?
Well, I think that it's only sensible that any person who is carrying a deadly weapon, a firearm, with them in society have proper and extensive training. Part of the problem with civilians doing these things is that they don't have the same kind of training at all that police officers do. And even police officers, who are the most highly trained occupation among persons who carry firearms, police officers make mistakes too. As a matter of fact, studies have shown that police officers in an actual fire situation hit the targets that they're aiming at between 20% and 30% of the time. Civilians inevitably would have an even lower score rate, because in a real situation, it simply ratchets up the terror, the insecurity, the anxiety, and it does not bode well for what is, in fact, a pretty safe society. I mean, crime has been declining in America for over 20 years. We're a pretty safe place, frankly, and it's pretty hard to summon a criminological argument saying how that would be improved by more civilians carrying guns.
Robert, thanks a lot for joining us.
It's good to be with you.
That was Robert Spitzer, Distinguished Service Professor and Department Chair for Political Science at the State University of New York, Cortland. He joined us to look at a bill proposed that people in Wisconsin could carry concealed weapons without a permit and without training.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, agriculture is a huge part of Wisconsin's culture and history, but many young people aren't going into farming. We talk with a lawmaker who wants to make it a little easier for a new generation to join the field.
Right now, it's time for our weekly check-in on the latest in national politics. The FBI is currently investigating alleged Russian interference in the 2016 presidential election, so are congressional committees, but there's some roadblocks to that investigation coming from different parts of the government.
The recent failed GOP health care bill could spell trouble for Republicans going forward, and Donald Trump's son-in-law is heading up a task force on government innovation. We'll take a look at what that task force will do and why some people are skeptical.
Harry Enten is with us to break down the latest. He's a senior political writer and analyst for 538.com. Harry, welcome back.
Thanks for having me back.
A lot going on. Let's dive in. You wrote an interesting piece on that non-vote on the health care bill. And Congress, the Republicans, it's a little more complicated than it might look. People are talking, oh, the conservatives over here, the moderates over here. You say there's a whole nother axis, another dimension we should be paying attention to, kind of insiders versus outsiders, or establishment versus anti.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, there are basically really two groups who were against the health care bill that was proposed by Paul Ryan and the Republicans among the Republican Party. One is that more moderate wing, which obviously worries about reelection. But there were a whole bunch of people that some had described as being conservative, that is the Freedom Caucus, who were up front, who were very much against the bill. But it turns out that there were plenty of conservatives who were also for the bill. But when you look at the dynamics that were going on, this Freedom Caucus, it's not just that they're conservative that is what distinguishes them, but it's also the fact that they seem to think that ideology is more important than party, and that they're willing to take on the party leadership and not particularly care if something is good for the party if it doesn't align with their ideology. And I think that is a key thing that is missing from this whole debate, was that they couldn't convince the Freedom Caucus, the Republican leadership, to vote for this bill merely for the good of the party, because these types of people don't necessarily think about that first and foremost.
With the question, what's next out there, is this going to make it difficult to do things like tax reform or infrastructure or any of the other big priorities from Republicans and from the Republican president?
I think it certainly makes those more difficult. Doesn't make it impossible, but the fact that you have this group of, say, 25 to 30 members of the House among the Republican side, who basically are saying my way or the highway, or have the ability to say that, and the Republican majority is such that they can only allow for so many people to leave their side, it makes the Freedom Caucus much more of a player and could drag the party further to the right. But at the same time, if the party goes further to the right, it could leave some of those moderate Republicans less willing to side with the party leadership.
And we hear talk about can the president work with Democrats? Can Republicans reach for their moderates and maybe lure some Democrats over for a future health care bill or whatever? What do those prospects look like?
You know, I have to be honest. Every single time that I hear that Donald Trump wants to work with Republicans, I laugh.
Democrats.
And the reason I laugh is because this is a president of the United States who accused the Democratic nominee of, you know, basically committing a crime and saying that she would be thrown in jail. And at the same time, if you look at how many Democrats are voting with the president of the United States so far in this Congress, it's quite low, and his approval ratings among Democratic voters is among the lowest I've pretty much ever seen.
So could we be looking at gridlock even with one-party control of the whole shebang?
Well, we could be, but of course, you know, there's still time to be done. You know, we're only two months in, right? So we'll see where things go. But the fact that you have so many divisions within the House Republican caucus, and then you combine that with the Senate having its own issues and the Republican Senate being more moderate than the Republican House, to me, it suggests that they'll have some more difficulty passing bills than I think a lot of people thought, although not an impossible task.
Talking to Harry Enten from 538.com about the top stories in national politics. Let's look at the latest on the Russia investigation. Harry, saying Russia investigation really is a shorthand for so much stuff going on. What's the latest part of the story you're watching?
I think the real part of the story that I'm watching is the differences between the Republican. Remember, there's a House investigation going on and there's a Senate investigation going on. And then, of course, the FBI has its own investigation that's going on. So we have multiple investigations. But to me, the most interesting aspect is how the House Republican led effort, led by Representative Nunes, has really become a partisan affair with Adam Schiff, the Democratic leading member of that investigation, basically saying we can't trust Representative Nunes. While on the Senate side, it does seem that Democrats are working much better with Republicans. Mark Warner, the Democratic senator from Virginia, is working very well with Senator Richard Burr in North Carolina. And so I think if we're going to see real movement out of this investigation from a body of Congress, it's probably going to come from the Senate side, because the House side at this point looks like an absolute mess.
Yeah, a week ago, Representative Nunes had this impromptu-ish press conference talking about new information he'd been given. It turned out on the White House grounds about incidental collection of Trump campaign data, conversations, things like that. And that's been a big storm ever since then. And then he went and briefed the Trump administration about this.
Yeah, that to me was, you know, one of the big things is that he basically went an investigation that could be involving the White House that's supposed to be taking place in the Congress, and then going and talking to the White House, or at least members of the White House on White House property, struck a lot of people as being not ethically very questionable. And the real thing to me going forward is whether or not the Republicans, a storm of Republicans who are asking Nunes to step aside. Right now he has the back of Speaker Paul Ryan, so that makes it a little bit more difficult. But if there's this drip, 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 that's when this investigation in the House could spiral out of control and Nunes might be asked to step aside by more than just the Democrats.
And there's the Senate investigation. You mentioned some Democrats, and even I think John McCain has said, you know what, we probably need an independent investigation, not run by partisans in either House of Congress.
Yeah, that is what Senator John McCain said. And again, this just goes back to what we were talking about earlier in the conversation, is that the Senate does seem to be a little bit more moderate in its ways and doesn't seem necessarily to be as entrenched in the partisan ways of Washington that we've all become used to. And so it'll be interesting to see how much movement comes out of the Senate. But I think the fact that you had a joint press conference earlier today between Senator Mark Warner and Senator Richard Burr, Republican, indicates that that investigation has much more of a chance of succeeding and perhaps moving forward.
Speaking of the Senate, to the Supreme Court nominee Neil Gorsuch, Democrats, a lot of them are saying no now, making it look less and less likely that Republicans can clear that 60-vote hurdle to avoid filibuster and avoid maybe the nuclear option. What are you watching for there?
You know, this is the question that has been we've been asking for the past few months. To me, it was fairly clear early on that Gorsuch, based upon his record, was not going to get 60 votes for confirmation. The question was whether or not there'd be 60 votes for an up or down vote. That, as you said, seems a lot more unlikely. And now the question is, does one side blink or not? And if you hear what each side is saying, I think that there's no conclusion to be reached other than the most likely outcome is that the nuclear option will be invoked by Mitch McConnell and the Republican Party, and it will get rid of the possibility in the future for nominees of the Supreme Court to be filibustered.
And the nuclear option meaning we don't need those 60 votes anymore. And Democrats had taken that in effect for lower court judges, not Supreme Court. So this, the filibuster keeps disappearing from some of these key Senate decisions.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. As you know, the filibuster isn't, you know, is not something that's written in the Constitution. It's not like there's some great law that's overriding all of it, the idea that you can speak and basically debate for forever without a vote being held. And I think we're seeing the dismantling of that. You know, filibusters have been certainly on the rise over the last 30, 40 years. And before that, they were only used in very specific circumstances. And now what we're seeing is they're being used a lot more, and people are getting sick and tired of it, and they want up or down votes.
And Democrats learning that if they take away, if they give themselves more power while they're in the majority, well, the Republicans come into the majority, they get that power in turn.
And that's exactly right. You know, it's the funny thing is I sometimes think that majorities think that their majorities are going to last for forever, and they make rules that work for them when they're in the majority, but perhaps when they go to the minority, it won't work nearly as well. And I think what we're seeing in the Senate is a great example of that. But, you know, on the other end of the spectrum, you know, Republicans didn't even allow a hearing for Merrick Garland, who was initially going to be the nominee for the Supreme Court seat. And now I think Democrats were so upset about that that they're willing to lose the filibuster, if only to make a point on Neil Gorsuch.
Let's take a quick look at President Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner. He's going to head a business SWAT team, something that's going to try to create innovation in government, more efficiencies, drawing from the business world. A lot of presidents have vowed to make Washington work better. Is this different than past administrations?
I don't know if it's so different. I mean, perhaps it's a little bit different in terms of, you know, who's leading it and Trump bringing in his son-in-law and a businessman and so on and so forth. But, you know, some people have pointed out it sounds awfully similar to an effort that was led in 1992, I believe, by the Bush White House, you know, to create, you know, a SWAT team to hit down bureaucracy. So it's what he promised, but to me, it's not anything that's extraordinary.
Harry, new data you're watching for briefly as we wrap up?
The only thing I'll be watching for is I'm very interested in the Georgia 6th congressional district runoff in a few weeks. If Democrats can do well there, it could be a good sign for them in the future for the House.
Harry, thanks as always for joining us.
Thank you.
That's Harry Enten, senior political writer and analyst for 538.com. He joined us to talk about the latest in national politics.
Coming up after the news, young people who want to farm in Wisconsin could get some student debt relief if a bill in the assembly passes. We'll talk with a lawmaker whose bill aims to attract young people to the field of farming. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, Governor Walker's self-insurance plan for state workers is supposed to save the state money, but members of the Budget Committee are skeptical. We'll find out why.
First, a bill being reintroduced in the Assembly aims to encourage more young people to become farmers in Wisconsin. Among the potential incentives being offered in the legislation is student debt relief.
Farming can be an expensive endeavor and a career that doesn't always make families a lot of money. But for those who want to become farmers, it can be a labor of love. We like to hear from younger people out there who are farmers or would like to become farmers. What challenges do you face? What would help you? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Democratic Assembly Representative Mark Spreitzer of Beloit joins us now. He's the author of the bill. Representative Spreitzer, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me on.
Well, why did you decide that it was time to put out a bill like this that would help farmers pay for education?
Wisconsin's farmers are aging, as farmers are across the country. The average age of a farm operator in Wisconsin is about 54 and a half years old, and that's according to the most recent 2012 data, and I suspect it's gotten older since then. And there's really twice as many farmers between the ages of 55 and 74 as between the ages of 25 and 44. So when we look at those numbers, we really need to recruit and retain a new generation of farmers if we want to keep the family farm going in Wisconsin, and I think that's so important to our rural communities that we do that. And at the same time, we've seen a a surge in interest among young people in farming, including people who didn't grow up in a farm background. But many of those people have student loan debt. It's important to get an education to be a farmer, whether that's specifically related to farming or business, or even people who, you know, went off to school to study something else and then decided to go into farming. And we see that student loan debt being an issue for so many people who've graduated from some form of higher education. But especially if you're getting started as a farmer, your income is probably not very high. You want to be saving money for land or equipment. There's all sorts of other kinds of debt that most farmers have to take on. And so I wanted to do something to relieve the burden of student loan debt so that people can focus on farming.
And could you talk a little bit about what you were getting at there, about the link between a higher education and being a successful farmer?
So farming today has become even more technical. There's a lot of technology that comes into play in terms of the equipment, and whether it's with tractors or with irrigation systems, with if you're raising livestock, the veterinary aspect of that, how to care for them. There's also a lot of farmers today are trying to find ways to market their own products with community-supported agriculture and farmers markets, and adding value to their products in order to make a good living, and those require a lot of different skill sets. There's the financial piece of being able to understand how to make money and the debt that you're taking on. And so all of that means that farmers really need an education beyond high school, and we know that that's expensive no matter where people get it. And so my bill targets a range of different educational opportunities that people might pursue, the Farm and Industry Short Course at UW-Madison, technical college programs, including certificates, diplomas, and associate's degrees, all the way up to a bachelor's degree that somebody might have, and trying to make sure that whatever kind of education they've gotten, that we're helping with the debt from that so that they can focus on their career as a farmer.
And if I've got this right, they could commit to running a farm for 5 years, but they could also go back to run a family farm. They could work on a farm, or they could manage a farm. So it sounds like there's a range of options to qualify.
Yeah, there are a range of options. The main concern is that farming be their primary occupation, and whether that's on their own farm or somebody else's, if they have financial need and they're on a farm that qualifies, then they would qualify for the program.
And have you heard from young people maybe who would go into farming if there weren't this prospect of debt and the financial aspects, who would take you up on this bill?
Absolutely. I've talked to both people who themselves are young farmers, and also to people who are thinking about it, or some of the young farmers I've talked to have told me about people that they went to college with who aren't farming but would like to be, and that the student debt is one of those issues. I've talked to two young farmers in my district, one who is currently paying off loans and has talked about how that's really preventing him from advancing his career as a farmer. He's managing somebody else's farm. He'd like to someday possibly have his own, but he's not able to save any money toward that. Then another farmer who was lucky enough to be able to have his parents pay for his education, but he went to school with a lot of people who didn't have that opportunity and took on debt to finance their education, and they're not able to be farming the way that he is, going back to his family's farm, because they're paying off those student loans.
And farming, you know, as a whole, it may not be the most lucrative career that somebody could choose to go forward with. Do you think there are other aspects beyond student loans that also need to be addressed to bring young people into that field?
Yeah, there absolutely are. The biggest financial challenges and just logistical challenges of becoming a farmer have to do with access to land and access to financing for equipment. And land in particular is a challenge if somebody's not going back to the family farm, or if the family farm isn't necessarily large enough to support the next generation, if the previous generation is still relying on that for farm income. And so I'm trying to explore, you know, ways that we can better connect retiring farmers who may not have a family member that wants to take over the farm, connect them with young people who may not have access to land, and help develop those mentoring relationships. There's not an easy answer to how to do that, but I think it's one of the things we need to be looking at as we go forward. The student loan issue is really just one small piece of the challenge, and I'm hoping if we can tackle that, we can also look at some of the other challenges.
We're talking with Representative Mark Spreitzer from Beloit, and he's introduced legislation that aims to bring more young farmers into the farm industry by helping to pay down their student debt. And Representative Spreitzer, this is something that you have taken a page from the book in New York. They have a legislation like this. How is it working there so far?
In New York, it's worked well. It's been going for a couple of years now, and I had a chance to read a testimonial from one of the young farmers who had gotten help there. I also got some information about things that that maybe didn't work as well. In New York, they initially required that somebody start farming and apply for the program. I think it was within only 2 years of graduating from whatever college they had gone to, and sometimes somebody can't really get their farm career started that quickly to qualify for the program. So in my bill, we extended that out to 5 years, and that was specifically based on feedback from the New York program. So it was nice that somebody went ahead, and I was able to look at that as a model, but we really customized this idea to Wisconsin based on how things work here and some of the things that didn't work well in New York.
And what is your sense about the prospects for this bill, in particular gaining enough, hopefully bipartisan support to move forward?
Well, I'm actively working on that. The bill does have bipartisan support, and I'm working on getting more bipartisan co-sponsors before I officially introduce it, and that will be happening shortly. And I'm hoping that it will get a public hearing and have an opportunity for legislators to see how much support I think there will be for this bill. I serve on the Assembly Agriculture Committee, where I hope this bill gets referred to, and I'll be talking with the chair to ask for a hearing as soon as it's formally introduced.
Now let's talk about the funding for the bill. How would this bill be paid for? How would this program be paid for?
The program would be paid for with general purpose revenue. That's the main source of funding for most of our state programs that comes from a variety of tax dollars. And it would be given out in a way that I think is pretty accountable, making sure that each annual payment that a young farmer gets, they have to show documentation that they're continuing to farm and meet the requirements, and that they're paying down their student loans. If they stop doing that, they wouldn't get additional payments. And I think this is a good investment in the future of farming when we consider that agriculture is one of the biggest parts of our state economy.
And are you, again, optimistic about your fellow lawmakers going for a bill that would require some money from the general fund like this?
Well, that's probably the biggest hurdle that this bill faces. Any bill that spends money is a challenge, and it's a matter of figuring out priorities. I think as we move through this budget process, we'll have to see how much money ends up being available. But, clearly agriculture is a priority for the legislature, for the state. And so I'm hoping that, this is a very small amount of money that I'm asking for, only $120,000 for the first year, up to $600,000 a year once the program is fully up and running. And that's a pretty small amount of money compared to things that we spend on a lot of other issues that really are not as central to our state as agriculture is.
And as we wrap up, what is your sense about why this matters, about why it's important to Wisconsin and to Wisconsin's economy to get young farmers out there and working?
The family farm is central to our heritage and really to our economy, to rural communities, and we need to preserve the family farm for the next generation, and that means we need a new generation of family farmers. And I think that without that, we're going to continue to see challenges in our rural communities. We're going to continue to see larger quantities of land being farmed by fewer people, and that just doesn't support the rural economies that we need to preserve the rich heritage of our state.
Representative Spreitzer, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Democrat Mark Spreitzer represents Beloit in the State Assembly. He joined us to talk about his new bill, which aims to encourage young people to become farmers in the state by offering incentives like student debt relief.
We'll take your calls in just a moment at 800-642-1234. Are you just out of high school or college thinking of going into farming? If you want to do that, what's holding you back? Would this bill help you? What would you like to see happen with farming in Wisconsin? And are you a farmer, young or old? What are your thoughts on bringing new farmers into the field? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll continue our conversation in just a little bit. Stay with us here on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. We've been talking about a new bill in the State Assembly which looks to cultivate young farmers in Wisconsin. One part of the bill is looking to reduce some of the financial burdens faced by young farmers, including providing student debt relief to farmers who participate in the program.
We go to your calls now at 800-642-1234. Are you a younger person, a millennial who is looking to get into farming? What would help you out? Are you a farmer? What are some of the challenges you face? If you're an older farmer, maybe thinking about retiring, do you have a succession plan? Who's going to take over the farm when you're no longer working it? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. To our callers now, Owen in Wyoega is with us. Owen, hi.
Hi, how's it going? I just want to thank you guys for bringing this up and putting it on the radio, because this is an important topic and it makes a lot of sense. I think as time goes on and the more we think about what consumer and people that live in the state of Wisconsin want, they also want to preserve the landscape and the small farm appearance of this state. And I believe that if we continue to make it unattainable for a smaller family farm to operate in a manner that is capable of letting them pay their debt and continue to maintain a livable wage or income without being so financially strapped that they aren't capable of making a living that's going to be able to pay their bills, then, you know, we're going to have too many large farms and not enough small family farms operating.
And Owen, are you a farmer yourself?
Well, yes. Yeah, I'm working for a larger farm. You know, it's a family-sized larger farm, but it is a larger farm. And the problem I see with just giving a student loan debt repayment type of incentive is a lot of these really large farms in Wisconsin are owned by veterinarians and people that have other type of college degrees that potentially they have a source of income that is a lot more of a professional type of source of income, where they're using that type of credit on, you know, getting a student loan debt relief for a lot larger sum of money that somebody would need to borrow. And somebody like me who went to college for business management at a little state college, never went into business per se. I work in dairy business, and I use and constantly am getting, you know, a return from what my education did for me, but my education was pretty inexpensive.
Gotcha.
Okay.
Owen, thanks a lot for that call. I want to bring on some of our other callers at 800-642-1234 as we talk about farming and older farmers leaving the occupation, leaving agriculture, and younger farmers, not enough of them stepping up.
And we'll take our next caller now. We've got Taylor on the line with us from Winona, Minnesota. Taylor, hi.
Hi, guys. I just wanted to say I would support this bill if I was a Wisconsin resident, but obviously I'm not. But one of the other things that I think is hard for young farmers like me, who's I'm 27 years old, to break in to the industry or to start our own farms, is access to capital. That seems to be the biggest barrier I've faced.
And Taylor, does the debt load that a young farmer like yourself might carry, do you think, interfere with access or getting, you know, an approval from a bank?
I don't have a whole lot of debt, a high debt load. I only went to a technical school for about 3 months for ag, and then I realized working on the farm and getting paid, I was learning twice as much and getting paid to do it. It's just they require...
such high credit ratings, and you got to have a lot to back it up, basically.
Taylor, thank you so much for calling and sharing that experience. Something else to look at down the road.
We'll go next to Joan with us in Waterville. Joan, hi.
Hello. I am concerned about who we are considering to be farmers anymore in this world and in this state of Wisconsin, especially. These so-called farmers, these so-called farms are expanding hugely so that they can get their extra bushels of corn and soy and destroying natural habitat. They've destroyed the monarch's habitat by 90%. We have lost 90% of our monarchs, and the main reason, according to the Environmental Defense Fund, is that these growers, I call them poison growers because they're just spreading poison all over those genetically modified plants that are making some of the animals that eat them sick, and then the people eat the animals, and the people get sick.
Gotcha. Joan, thanks for the call. Joan saying not going for the bigger farmers there in state support, it sounds like. Thanks for your call, Joan, at 800-642-1234. Talking about difficulties bringing younger people into farming, we heard from a state lawmaker a few minutes ago who had at least some suggestions, a bill he's working on in the state legislature, a student loan debt forgiveness for people going into farming, some other parts of that as well. You can join in at 800-642-1234.
And back to the phones, we've got a call here from TJ in Clinton. Hi, TJ.
Hi, how are you guys doing today?
Good, thanks.
So the reason I'm calling is kind of a half question, half a viewpoint. You know, hearing about this bill, I'm currently enrolled in school, and I also help out on my family's farm. It's a really small farm operation with livestock. And I'm, you know, kind of want to put a viewpoint out there that this bill should be accessible to more younger folks in my situation, where I'm going to school actively now for engineering, because engineering obviously is going to help refine skills that on the farm and the farming operation itself. But because I'm in school and I'm helping at the farm at the same time, I think it'd be a better idea to have this available to current students to help pay down the debt as it's being built up. I think by time any student gets done with school nowadays, that final bill on how much you actually owe is just such a staggering amount that we should probably have more incentives and programs to get students who are currently enrolled in school participating in jobs on farms to help pay down the debt as they go, so that by the time that they're done with school, it's not such a staggering amount, and it seems more manageable. You know, a little more peace of mind by the time you're done if you're already halfway paid off.
And TJ, are you interested, when you finish school, are you interested in making that your vocation, working full-time on a farm in some capacity?
Absolutely. I don't know if it'll still be my family farm, per se. I'm actually kind of hoping to end up with my own farm in the end. However, we've got just a large enough operation at our family farm that I could definitely be there for quite a few years ahead.
Well, TJ, thank you so much for calling and sharing your thoughts on that. And Representative Spreitzer may still be looking for thoughts from people on that. Appreciate you calling and sharing.
Time for one more caller, Valerie, with us in Milwaukee. Valerie, briefly, what do you think?
Hi, I'm just calling. My husband and I were city slickers, and we're really, really interested in farming, and we don't know how to get started, and we don't even know if it's necessarily a career that we want, but we're very interested in doing it, and we're just wondering if we can somehow connect with a mentor farmer, or just something like that, just to figure out if it's right for us.
And
if it's...
We've talked about mentor farmers. I don't have contacts in front of me now, but that's something you'd be interested in, at least to take that first step before trying to take the whole plunge, huh?
Yeah, exactly.
All right, Valerie, thanks so much. We'll try to scout up some information on that and post that on the Central Time Facebook page if we can find that in a little bit. I feel like we've done a whole interviews about that before. But thank you so much for that call, Valerie.
Appreciate that. And we go next to Angie quick call here from Angie in Eau Claire. Angie, hi.
Hi. So I was just curious as to the age group. I am a veteran and also a non, I'm an older student. So where do you fit, like, where's the age group for that? I currently am a farmer also. I crop farm. But I'd like to get into, like, beef cattle.
Angie, thank you so much. And I don't have all the specifics on the bill before me. It still has to pass quite a few hurdles before it becomes the law in Wisconsin here in a program that's accessible. So that might be something to refer you to Representative Spreitzer on that. But thank you, everyone, for your calls and your thoughts today as we look at the future of farming.
You can keep the conversation going with your experiences on the Central Time Facebook page. The draft of some song lyrics with references to Milwaukee, Madison, and Wauwatosa is going up for auction in Los Angeles tomorrow.
And the claim to fame on the lyrics in question? Well, they were written by Nobel Prize winner Bob Dylan, who, by the way, just finally agreed to accept his Nobel Prize. Kind of a drag getting the prize, but Dylan is being a sport about it. He's going to accept it.
At the bidding for these lyrics, he scrawled them down, I think, on a tour through Wisconsin. The bidding starts at $30,000 if you're looking to get in on the game. Officials say it could go much higher.
That's right. Apparently, he went to summer camp here and spent some time in Wisconsin and felt kind of fondly about Wisconsin, which I never knew before. It's neat to see Dylan's handwriting with these lyrics. He plays with words. He changed Wauwatosa to Wow Wow Toaster, which is probably how we should say it from now on.
I'm sure people in the toaster community would be all, well, maybe not. So this is a song. He had written some lyrics. This is not something that he ever recorded as far as anybody
Not that tell. I'm aware of, unless someone is sitting on the forgotten Wisconsin Dylan Bob Dylan song.
Maybe somebody was at summer camp. He did it at the talent show.
Ooh, I like it.
If you've got this, let us know. Central Time exclusive, the lost Bob Dylan Wisconsin song. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. The cracked bills and washed out horns blew into my face with scorn, but it's not that way. I wasn't born to lose.